Hey, Steve. Greetings.
How you doing, Shane?
Good, good. How are you, Steve?
Good.
I wanted to start with you, actually. We're going to talk about some other things today, but I did want to just check in with you on the little exercise I gave you last week, which was checking in on what contributes to your enjoyment and what tends to take away from that enjoyment.
Ashamed to say, I did not do that exercise.
All right. Well, let's
That
do that. What we'll do is, while I'm welcoming some people, you can just take a minute and note a couple of things, if you will, while you're on the call. It'll help, I promise.
that.
All right, Christine, welcome. Dorothy, greetings. Hi,
Hey
everybody.
there.
Good to see you guys.
Thanks for the reminder text. I was like, oh my God, where is it? Thank you. I
No
appreciate that.
problem. No problem. Good to see you all. All right. So today we're going to be talking about the five leadership languages. And this falls in the category that I call self-awareness. And I don't have the slide up. We'll do it again another week, probably. But I want to tell a brief story. And I'm going to tell you how I developed the tool that I'm about to introduce you to. So last week was the Enneagram. We did a deep dive on that, and I think we had some fun. This week will be a lighter version of that. So this is in the category of self-awareness. And this particular tool is really designed to help you map your team even more than you, the people that you're leading. And so this is a tool that you can give to people. And they can take this and it can help you. Let me just find the actual quiz here. All right. So what we can do, so I just put it in the chat. You can grab that anytime and look at this quiz. But what I'm going to do is walk you through it and how it works and what the results are, and then you can use this with your team. So the one of the first things that happened to me when I went from being the pastor of a very small church of about 300 to a pastor of a very big church was within about 2 months we lost 500 people. And so that was like almost twice the number of the church that I had left. So it was like 300 people was the first church, and we lost 500. It was a church of about 6,000. And I laugh because that's a significant achievement. And it was a direct result of my preaching. And there was a chairman of Herman Miller, who was a member of the church, and the elders asked him to come and talk to me because they were not happy with how things were going. And one of the lessons that I had learned in my first church was that when you are the pastor of 300 people, you have 600 bosses. Like the number of opinions about who you are and how you're supposed to show up multiplies. And I learned over time to effectively just be myself and let people kind of fall where they may. And that was a really important lesson for me. Well, when I got to the big church and people were giving me feedback, oh, we're losing people, this is going on. I was like, it's not my problem. This is who I am. They need to get used to it. And the senior leader sat me down, or not senior leader, but the chairman sat me down and he said, Shane, let me ask you some questions about who you are and what you believe and what you're about. And so we talked for quite a while. And at the end of that, he said, okay, Shane, I need you to know that there's a huge gap between how you're being experienced and who you really are. And that gap is causing the loss of people. So he said, you have a choice. You can either reinvent yourself as a communicator, or we can help you find another church context to serve in. And I was like, oh, well, that's a whole different story. I should probably pay attention to what you're saying. So what I learned was that I had even though I thought this would be a natural fit, that I had no credibility in my new context, that there were language patterns I was using that was leading people to not find me to be credible. And as a result, I was totally ineffective. And I spent about the next 2 months reworking myself as a communicator. And sure enough, it changed things and people were coming back and everything stabilized and it was fine. But it was a really powerful lesson where I learned kind of this immense need for credibility, even though I was established as a thought leader in that world and I had published books and I was, you know, on a big stage and just assumed that would give me credibility, but it didn't. And I also watched this happen several other times where leaders would leave big companies and go to small companies. And even though they were very credible in their big company, they were losing credibility in the smaller company. So I found credibility to be this fascinating stock ticker symbol that rises and falls invisibly for leaders with every word they say and every decision they make. And so credibility was a really big thing that was always in the back of my mind, like how you establish credibility. And then when I left the church and I began doing what I do professionally now, the very first thing that I do for every new leader that I work with is a 360 interview of all the people they work with. And I remember after doing dozens of these that I would sit down and I'd ask people questions, you know, how's this leader doing? What do you like? What are they ineffective in? What could work better? And I got certain things back that were really universal. You know, so things like clarity. I never had anybody say to me, you know, I really don't need any clarity from my leader. So that was like a universal thing. I was like, oh, that's like something people need from their leader is clarity. Another thing was respect, you know, basic respect. No one ever said, I don't really need anybody to respect me. And then the last one was, I think the word I use typically is like standards, or people wanted to know that everybody was being held to the same standard, that there weren't being favorites being played. And so sometimes that's about how you reward people, but it's basically clarity, respect, and standards or rewards were three things that were just universal, everybody needed and wanted from their leader. But then I started to notice that there were certain things that people cared passionately about and were quite critical of a leader that the next person I would talk to could care less about that and had a completely different issue that they were worked up about. So one person I'd talk to and they're like, you know, I love the leader, good CEO, but the problem is they're just never in the office. I don't know where they are. I don't trust that they're seeing what I'm doing. I don't think they're making decisions informed by what's happening on the ground. I don't know how to trust that leader. I'm just really concerned. And then I go to the next person and I'd say, what's going on with you? And they'd talk. And then I'd say, any concern about the leader being out of the office? And they're like, no, not at all. Totally fine with it. Works for me. You know, they're doing their job. I'm doing my job. What do I need them for hanging around here? And I started to go, well, that's interesting. How do I give this feedback to a leader? When it's like, well, some people like this and other people don't like that. And how do I begin to aggregate this? And over the years of doing it, I started to see patterns emerge. And as a result of all those patterns, I began to see there were five basic, what I call leadership languages that are unique to people. So this is leadership languages, the way that I'm using that term really refers to how you like to be led more than how you tend to lead, though it's related. So it's how somebody wants to be led by a leader, which directly impacts two things, their view of your credibility and their motivation. How motivated they are to go to work for you. And so what I'm going to do today is just walk you through those five leadership languages. And technically there's 10, they're really just five pairs that are opposite languages. And one set of languages are more public and in view, and another set of languages are more hidden. And so that's what we're going to talk about today. I'll just share my screen briefly and kind of walk you through some of the high points of the system. All right, let me see here. Another one thing. I think when I do this, I have to, it's a keynote. Yeah, there we go. Everybody can see this, I presume. So here are the five leadership languages. One of the first ones that actually is one of the more common ones is mentoring. So somebody who has scores high on the language of mentoring signs up to work for a company in large part because of the person they're going to learn from. They want to be actively invested in by a leader or a manager. And so you'll find this is really common among younger staff, or it could be common for people who have migrated to another kind of role that they're new to and they're trying to figure it out. And so they want to be invested in. And so what's really interesting is if you score really high on mentoring and your supervisor is out of the office a lot and doesn't really invest in you and doesn't really coach and doesn't ask questions and doesn't spend time with you, that becomes one of the most important currencies for them to trust you and feel motivated. And so it's something that's then lacking for them, and it can impact their performance, motivation, and your credibility. So that's kind of the first main language. Now, there is an opposite to this. What might be an opposite language to mentoring? What's the opposite of mentoring? What would you say?
Or like an autonomous situation where they just leave you alone and let you do your thing.
Yeah. So it could be autonomy. That's great. I use a different word because I actually make a distinction between empowerment and autonomy, even though they're very similar. So the kind of what I call the hidden language is empowerment. And it's hidden because it's usually not as spoken. And it we'll talk more about hidden languages at the end. But effectively, what it's saying is, this is for people who have lots of expertise. I've been around for a long time. In fact, you've hired me because I know more than you about this thing. And so what I want is the power to execute and act. I need to have the authority invested in me. I don't need you to spend a lot of time coaching me. I need you to actively grant me power and authority. And so empowerment is a little bit distinct from autonomy because autonomy is more about the ability to do what I want when I want, which is different than, and not having to report back out, which is different than I need the power to enact things. And so people who have empowerment as their primary language are searching for that mandate. And what happens is if you are, let's say you're a leader who loves to mentor and somebody has empowerment as their primary language, they're going to get increasingly irritated by the fact that you're always trying to coach and teach and train them. And they're like, kind of know more about this than you do, and I don't really need your input as much as you think I do. And so so that's empowerment. Now, what's really interesting about these two is often a leader will have somebody who has empowerment as their highest language, and they are not really qualified to be empowered. And so you have this really interesting dynamic that's like, ah, come on, give me the ball. And you're like, yeah, you're not ready for the ball. And so one of the things that we use this tool for is to help have conversations like that, where you go, hey, I notice empowerment is one of your most important languages. That's great. Want to make sure you're getting that experience. You'd ask then, what does empowerment look like to you? Where do you feel like you're not getting the empowerment you need? And if they say, well, I feel like I don't need your oversight on here. I don't need that. And if you disagree and feel they really do, then you just say, hey, no problem. In order for you to get that empowerment, here are the things that I'll need to see from you over the next 3 to 6 months. If I can see that over the next 90 days or whatever, then it's yours. But these things have to happen in order for you to get that. What you're doing is you're linking their fundamental need to the kind of performance that you most want to get from them. But you wouldn't know what their fundamental need is unless they were to take a quiz like the quiz that I've just given you a link to. It's free. It takes 5 minutes. And it just helps you map this minefield of hidden needs that different people on your team have more than others. So yeah, that's empowerment.
Do we have the ability to provide that quiz to our staff?
Yep. It's just use that link and people, they just give their email and they get access to it. And so anybody can use it at any time. Comments or questions about mentoring and empowering before we go to next one? All right, we're going to keep moving. Recognition. This is one of these languages that, unlike almost all the others, if you give this to someone and it isn't their primary leadership language, they're not really bothered by it. You know, you can give this to everybody. So recognition is a really powerful one to have available and to use and give. And recognition is just that verbal and or written or whatever acknowledgement that you did a great thing. People with high recognition often appreciate thank you. They appreciate apologies. They appreciate acknowledgement. That's oxygen for them. Now, not everybody needs to be recognized publicly. Sometimes someone might have a high recognition need, but they actually don't like it to be done in front of others. They want it to be done in a more private way. And so that's a worthwhile conversation. If someone you're leading scores really high on recognition, you can simply ask the question. And by the way, the quiz at the end, when you get the results, you can click through every single language and it'll give you how to have the conversation. Here's what it means to have this language. And here's the conversation you should have with them to know exactly what it means. Because I'll do a little write-up and they might read that and go, well, that's not exactly how it is for me. And so you use this as a conversation starter to say, okay, what does recognition feel like to you? When is it landing? When is it not? What's the opposite of recognition?
Basically, indifference.
I call it feedback. So what's really interesting is there are people who have a very high need for recognition. And then there are people that have no real desire for recognition. In fact, they think it's you're wasting their time. It's a waste of breath. Like, I don't need to be told what I'm doing good. I want to know what I could do better. And that's people who have a high need for feedback tend to want to be told the ways that they could improve. And so you can imagine how diametrically opposed this is, that if you as a leader tend to be really great at feedback, and let's say you yourself even score high in feedback, it's not uncommon that the language we score high in is how we tend to lead others. That if you have a high feedback need and you tend to lead others with feedback, imagine you're leading someone with recognition. All they're going to hear is all the things you're doing wrong. And that oxygen gets taken out of their life force. They're just like, oh my gosh, this is so difficult. Same thing with somebody who's got feedback. If all you're doing is celebrating them and telling them how great they are, they're going to be like, I don't even know that you mean any of this. They tend to be a little more suspicious. They're like, hey, are you sure? And so you're saying nice things all the time wears thin, because they're like, I want to know the truth. And I don't think I'm getting the truth. Even if you're telling the truth, they can be suspicious of that. So that's recognition and feedback. Comments or questions about these two together?
Shane, as you're talking through this, I was like, I have a little bit of everything, but is the goal to have one dominant one and then for us to recognize all the different patterns, like, you know, let's say the human design or whatever, you know, we talked about too. So is the goal to have a primary one once we take the quiz? Or is it for us to identify top two? Like, can you kind of give us a little bit more context of how this?
Yeah, great question. Yeah, so there is no goal in this other than to help you have missing conversations. So organizations only have problems and teams only have problems in the absence of the right conversation. So this tool is designed to give you a little bit of a cheat sheet and a map of where a missing conversation might be and how to have that missing conversation. And so you might score relatively even across a number of them, or you might discover that you're really high in one, and that's fine. Both are fine. What you're learning is if somebody scores relatively even and low across all of them, it just means they're not primarily motivated by one of these unique languages. They're still motivated by clarity, respect, and the standards, but this isn't the thing that they're going to need. Whereas for others, it's going to unlock something. They're going to be like, oh my gosh, yes, I'm highly motivated by this. And so a lot of it is just starting to understand and know. It's also the kind of thing that changes over time. It could change in different contexts. It could change based on what needs you have. So this is really like mapping a basket of needs in the moment that you have in work, particularly from your leader. Does that help?
Oh my gosh, amazing. Yes, thank you. Because I'm like, yes, I have all of these because they're all equally important to me. But yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
So I would encourage you to take the quiz because you might discover some are more important than others. Now we've only been through, you know, a couple. And so it's normal to have, you'll get a score that are kind of the top three highest languages for you. And then there might be some that are just completely absent that are just not important or interesting to you at all. So it'll be interesting to see.
I kind of imagine it depends on who it's coming from too. somebody can give you positive feedback or negative feedback. And the way it's perceived, and have a big impact.
In my language here, recognition is always positive. Feedback in this term is almost always around what needs to be improved or corrected or changed. So that's how I use these words. Good. Okay. So connection. Here's another fun one that's kind of interesting. Some people have an incredibly high need to feel connected to the person that they're being led by. And that means I want to know, it's not literally this all the time, but these are the kind of people that they want to feel like they're more than a cog in a machine. They want to feel that they know who you are as a person and that you know who they are as a person. And that gives them a sense of motivation. You know me, I know you, I relate to you, and I like you, and you like me. So I want to know, how was your weekend? I want to know what your vacation was like. I want to know about your kids. I want you to know about my kids and my vacation. Now, imagine if you have somebody who has this language and you're being led by a leader who has the opposite language, which is boundaries. So there are many people that come to work and they go, look, I have a life outside of work. That's a life I've chosen and I love. I don't need friends at work. I come to do the work. And so boundaries is all about, I don't need you to ask me how my weekend was. And I don't really want to talk about how my weekend was. And I don't want to know how your vacation was. And I'm good with not knowing. Now, anyone who has boundaries as a language, they're going to be polite and they're going to do the game. They're going to play along. But if you know somebody has boundaries, it's actually good to know that, because you're like, they just want to be efficient. They just want to kind of get in and go and do their thing. Now, imagine if you're a boundaries kind of leader and you don't really like to talk about the things that are going on in your weekend or whatever, but you've hired somebody who's super high in connection and you're just showing up like you would normally show up, the way you like, you are robbing that feeling of connection from them. And that's a really important thing. So leaders that have these two different opposing languages can create all kinds of issues and challenges. So it's helpful to know, like, oh, connection. And then you can ask them, like, hey, tell me about when is connection most meaningful to you? How does that show up for you? You know, it may not be that they want to hear about your weekend, but it may be that getting drinks after work is really important to them. And now you need to know, like, oh, that's like a thing that I need to do that I don't care about and I don't want to do. How do I navigate this? The fact that that's not how I'm wired, or vice versa. Like, I really like to connect and I like to know about my people and I want them to know me. And I got someone who just doesn't need that and doesn't want that. So that's kind of fun and interesting. Comments or questions about this? Okay. Purpose. Maybe you all have heard of Simon Sinek. He's become well known for a TED talk he gave on finding your why, you know, the higher purpose, the reason behind making money, the non-financial reason for being. There are a number of people that come into the world and they go, okay, we're all working on building a bridge across a waterway. For people that are motivated by purpose, they want to know that they're connecting people to what matters. Whereas, so that non-financial reason for being, that reason that you exist in the world and the value you're creating, if you are failing to provide that and make links for higher purpose and greater meaning and value in the world, you are demotivating these people actively. They will be looking for other kinds of work that's more meaningful to them. And even if you think, well, you know what, our business just isn't very purpose-driven or meaningful to begin with, well, you have to go digging then. You've got to find, like, what's that human impact? Module one is all about finding your why. And I teach you several methods for doing that and how to articulate it. And that becomes super powerful for linking people. The other thing that we do is we'll teach a method called OKRs, which is how you manage work against goals. And that's another way to link things to higher purpose. Now, there's another group of people that are motivated by performance far more than purpose. And so for them, building the bridge, having it not fall down, is deeply fulfilling. And the notion that the bridge connects people to what matters is kind of secondary, immaterial, not that important to them. And so while a growing number of people are motivated by purpose, there is still a large percentage of the population that is really just content to be like, I feel like doing a good job is meaningful to me. That's That's how I get meaning and significance. I don't need some highfalutin, high-minded purpose. So the reason to know about this is, in the same way that recognition you kind of need to have it in any business, you're going to need to have higher purpose in any business. You're going to need to have that felt. But not everybody's going to be super motivated by it. And so having some respect for the fact that certain people just don't care, and there's room for them to not care. So if somebody scores really high in performance and you're trying to get them excited about purpose, it's okay to say, hey, I know this isn't the top on your list of things to care about. We appreciate you being a participant anyway. Like, you give permission and allowance for them to effectively not care. So comments or questions about purpose and performance? All righty. And then the last one, proximity. Proximity could also be called visibility. It's not necessarily just physical proximity. And it's distinct from connection in that it's not about I need to be relationally close to you. It's that I need to know what you're doing and I want you to know what I'm doing. I want to make sure that we can see and understand what each other is doing, because if you can see what I'm doing, then I can trust that your decisions you're making are being informed by what's happening on the ground. And if I can see what you're doing, then I know that I can calibrate my actions according to the things that you're up to. And so that's what somebody who has a high need for proximity would be driven by. Whereas some people are the opposite, and that's where we bring in autonomy. And autonomy is really that feeling of, it's not that I need empowerment, it's not that I need a mandate, it's that I don't really need a lot of updates from you. I don't really like giving updates from me. I like just trusting we're all both doing our own thing, and I'm getting my work done, you get your work done, and we'll meet up down the road. And so those are two very different things, right? And one is about how do I get that regular communication and contact and this visibility and seeing? And the other is, how do I just free up more of my time to do the work I like doing and not have to report on and think about the work I'm doing? And I don't want to think about the work you're doing either, unless I absolutely have to. And so you can start to feel how all of these languages have a polarity, a push and a pull, a fundamental difference in how they show up. So when you look at all of them together, the languages that are kind of white versus language that are black, those white languages are fundamentally more common in organizations than they are for solopreneurs. These are the togetherness energy. So in any human relationship, you have two fundamental forces that are at work. One is the togetherness force that says, I want to be together. This is in a marriage and a business and a community. We want to be together. And then there's the separateness force, which is, I need to be my own individual independent person. And so these two things aren't an ongoing dance between togetherness and separateness. And the black languages are more separate, more individualized, more on their own. And the white ones are more connective tissues and wanting to be together and feel together. And so what's really interesting is often you'll have leaders who start businesses or do what they're doing, and they have very low need for mentoring, recognition, or connection because they want to venture off into their own and do their own thing. But in order to hire a bunch of people that want to be a part of something, they often will have the languages that are more togetherness languages. And so the leader will have this tendency to be like, well, I don't need to like have all this proximity with people. I don't need them, you know, to be empowered. And I'm not looking for I'm not looking for mentoring. And they will just translate that to the people they lead instead of actually mapping it and finding out. And so the quiz will effectively help you map this, and then it'll give you some indicators of how to deal with it once you have the results. So there you go. That's kind of the introductory work here to the five leadership languages. Comments or questions about what you're seeing here, how to use it, anything at all?
I could see how this could be very impactful in how you, because the more people you manage, the more likelihood that you're going to have a broad mix of all this, and you may have the best intentions and you're doing the exact wrong thing for that employee. I mean, exactly. I'm looking at this and I'm actually mostly on the black side.
Yes.
I don't know which, as a team, my five or not, but
it is the five. Yep. It's exactly right. That is the Enneagram five. Very, very common would be more on this bottom half. You know, and depending on the kind of groups you're leading. So like software engineers very often live on kind of the black. The role is tends to be a bit more isolated, focused on widgets and nuts and bolts. Whereas like if you're in a sales organization, these wider languages are going to be more to the fore. It's much more relational and out there and connected. So yeah, you're absolutely right. Steve, this is designed exactly like you said. It's meant to surface things, the conversations that no one's going to have on their own. Most people don't even know what their language is, even if you show them it. They won't necessarily know until they take the quiz. The quiz asks a series of questions in a very specific way to surface what each of these might be.
Very interesting.
So you can also see how this is much lighter than the Enneagram. You know, the Enneagram is quite depth and complex and intricate and very powerful, and I love it and I use it. But I also noticed that I just needed something that was a shortcut. You know, I charged 20 grand to go in and do a 360 leadership assessment of a CEO, and that's a very time-intensive, resource-intensive undertaking. And so I designed this five-minute quiz to effectively get a shortcut result that's similar to what I could get to these 360s, which you start going, oh, okay, this person needs that. I'm definitely not giving that.
May I ask a clarification question? Sorry. When you're talking about black and white, are you talking about the white on the top or are you talking about the white unfilled logos at the bottom?
So I should probably say top and bottom. Yeah.
So like, hold on. What are we saying? Because now I'm like, wrote something, but I feel like I wrote it backwards. So the ones on the top, mentoring, recognition, connection, purpose, this is more in the corporate world, in the leadership role. So like me as a pharmacy manager in the hospital, like that's where I belong. Now I'm a full-time entrepreneur. I'm like more on the bottom side, or is that vice versa? Did I get that wrong as a solopreneur?
Yeah, it could be like if you joined a company and you wanted to be a part of a company, it's not always this way, but very often just companies in general, people are drawn to be a part of something in part because of those needs on the top, which are more togetherness needs. Whereas when somebody starts their own thing, very often they might be much more motivated by what's on the bottom. They're like, I don't have a real need for a lot of things from my leader. I have a need to have space and, you know, to do the things that I need to get done. And so it starts to help you map this out. Now, maybe you've heard of the five love languages. I don't know if you guys have heard of that. It's a very famous book that really describes romantic relationships more often than work relationships. And Gary Chapman, who wrote that book, worked with a guy who does what I do for a living, and they tried to translate it into the corporate world. And they developed an inventory and did everything. And it was based on the love languages book, which they came up, they call it the five languages of appreciation in the workplace. And it is fundamentally flawed because one of their languages is physical touch because that's one of the love languages. And so you can imagine, you know, they admit it, they've had 70,000 people take their quiz. They've never had anybody score physical touch as one of their languages of appreciation in the workplace. And they define that as fist bumps and high fives and handshakes. And I'm like, it's a category confusion. And so when I did what I'm doing, I didn't even know they had done that. I developed this and then I found it later. And I was like, oh, they're trying to retrofit that into another model that exists somewhere else. This is born of the research I did indigenously in corporate world to find out what primary needs drivers are causing people to feel good or feel bad in any given context. So just another piece of context for all of you. Good. Any other comments or questions about that tool? Feel free to share it with your team. And if you're in a spot where you have people you're trying to motivate, that's going to be good. All right. Okay. So with that, we now open it to just open coaching, whatever's going on, whatever you're focused on, whatever you need. Steve, I gave you a little bit of an assignment. You may not have done it, but I wanted to at least open it up again to you just in case. you were dealing with feelings of burnout and kind of losing your mojo, as you called it. And we were looking at what does it mean to recover some of that. And so, you know, one interesting thing would be for you to take that 5 leadership languages quiz and ask yourself, are you getting some of the needs you have met in your context?
And as you were going through this, naturally making, because I know there's some of my staff, and this sounds horrible, but it's a simple fact, is there are those that I spend a lot of time and attention with, and there's others that kind of get the rest of me. That's neither fair nor probably best business practice, but unfortunately, that's how it is right now. And after our last call that last Wednesday, that next Thursday, one of the things we had talked about was me actually speaking with my CEO and determining with him what success looks like. And he and I talked Thursday morning, and something he and I had been working on for the last 6-7 months that we thought was going to be a big success got completely flipped upside down and shut off. So we are, and I won't bore the folks here with it, but we had a whole new business direction, another merger coming up, and access with Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, completely gone.
No way.
So I didn't smash anything, but I was close.
Wow.
It's been a great year.
I'm so sorry.
We just keep telling ourselves only 10 months to 2024.
at least you got a sense of humor about it. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, there's personal and professional stuff that's just been the worst year of my life so far, unfortunately. But
truly,
you're helping. You really are. It's just so you know that. To your questions right in the beginning of our call, what adds to my enjoyment? Feeling that I've made an impact and that I'm needed and that I can provide guidance where and when it's requested of me, where I can become, and I'm not a recognition seeker. I'm actually the introvert. I don't want to be publicly recognized necessarily, but I love to be able to have somebody come to me and I can take all the disparate parts and pieces, put it together, which is what I do. That's my role. In SVP enterprise performance. So I'm supposed to make all the crap work. I love having that ability and I'm pretty good at it. What detracts from my enjoyment, lack of understanding. So these different departments that I oversee, I'm more a mile wide and inch deep rather than having in-depth knowledge of each of those topics. And that's difficult at times because I'm brought into these meetings and people talk at that depth and I'm simply not there. And they look to me for an answer. I'm like, don't know. Still definitely have the feelings of inadequacy and the imposter syndrome. And right now, especially after what just happened last Thursday, we are adrift. We're a ship without a rudder. Not a great feeling.
Yeah, that's rough. So this is something that happened external. This is an externality, not something that happened in the business. It was something that happened in the marketplace or something that.
No, this is within our company. We have our bank has 7 different business lines. We had a merger that we've been working on for a while with a variety of different agreements and understandings and expectations and. For some things that are actually going wrong at the bank, they have probably for the third time done a complete 180. And it's just, I'm done. I'm tired of these whiplash decisions that make no sense. And, you know, we're in the worst time in the mortgage industry, pretty much in history. Even this is worse than, I can't say it's worse. It's different, but still equally as bad as 2007, 2008. We've got a way out. We thought we had it, and they just tossed it. So.
Oh my gosh. What a blow.
Yeah. So we're adrift again, and we've got, thankfully, my CEO has been he never pulled his other lines out of the water. So we still have some other things with some other companies that we're looking at. So he very smartly kept some doors open. But somehow going to him with our conversation with the last call of, you know, where does success really, you know, where does it look?
Yeah.
Wasn't the time to have that conversation.
Yeah, but, you know, actually, I think it's more relevant now than ever, especially for your own morale. I actually think now you can look at it and say, hey, given the kind of cataclysm that's upon us, we need to move the goalposts. And I need some clarity on where the goalposts should be now. You know, and you guys can, if that's a collaborative conversation, fine. But I think actually for you, the notion of, you mentioned several things, being able to make an impact, being able to bring disparate things together and make it work and fit. These are things that contribute to your joy. So again, everything we're after now is related to your own emotional system, your own sense of how I feel about the work I'm doing and how I feel about the people I'm working with and for. That matters at the paramount, as paramount now. You're at a stage in life where you, that should become the most important thing to you. You should really care a lot about how you feel about the work you're doing. Right. And so one of the things we talked about last time was frames. What kind of frames do you need to create for yourself so that it affects your emotional system in a new way? And, you know, when I talk about frames, I'm referring to quite literally how you choose to tell the story. So there are multiple stories you can tell. All of them are true. All of them have truth to them. But one story will make you feel a little better than the other. And it's not like we're looking for ecstasy. We're looking for relief. Is there a story you tell that provides just enough relief that as you tell that story, it improves your emotional context? And as your emotional context improves, your capacity to navigate and problem solve actually increases also. Usually under great stress, when there's too much anxiety or too much effectively depression, your capacity to solve problems drops dramatically. So that's why it's so important that we're focusing on. And by the way, everything I'm doing with you now is what you'll also have to do for the team below you at times. You'll have to help reframe and reset and tell different stories. So the metaphor that I often use is when I tell someone, oh, tell a different story, they often go, well, I don't want to be in denial about all the bad stuff that's going on. And my response to that is, you as a human being don't have a choice but to be in denial about something. You don't have the capacity to apprehend all of reality coming at you at all times. Your perceptual filters, your internal narratives are operating no matter what, whether you like it or not. So I compare it to, you know, I don't really care for rap music, but I really like alternative rock, let's say. Well, both of those things are playing on the radio right now. They're real. They're happening. But one I don't like and one I do like. So why is it that I always tune my radio to the station I do like and I ignore the station that I don't like, even though it's real and it's happening and it's playing? The reason is because it just feels better. I just prefer it. And what happens with people, it's really interesting, is we have a tendency to go find the story that has the most static around it, and we tend to attach to it. And it's the equivalent of me going, gosh, I hate rap. And every time I get in my car, I'm like, well, I'm going to listen to that rap station. I can't stand this rap. This is driving me crazy. It just hurts my ears. Better turn it up a little bit. You know, that's what people tend to do when they're operating out of the wrong frame. So the reason that I wanted you to have the conversation with the CEO about goalposts is it helps you begin to find the frame that might feel a little better, that gives you a little bit of relief. So I'll give you an example of a frame right now that you just talked about, which is one part of your leadership. You don't know what the right answer is. And so one frame, when you tell that story, is I'm not competent. Therefore, I'm probably not trusted, probably not respected. And I'm just not doing a good job. And I'm not probably ever going to develop the skill and the expertise these people have in order to be credibly able to lead that. So that's a story you can tell. I mean, if that's me telling that story, I'm depressed. That's rap music to me. That's a bad story, right? You could find a story that has just a little bit of relief, which is, it's not my job to fix all these things. It's my job to mobilize them to solve. I'm not qualified to make those decisions, and nor am I supposed to be. So while I have the authority to make decisions, I'm not actually qualified to make those decisions. And I can openly admit that without any shame. They know that. I know that. There's no reason to beat around the bush about it. Just to say, hey, well, I have the authority to make this decision. I'm candidly not qualified to make that decision. So I'm going to need you guys to do that. And I'm going to trust you to do that. Or if I know that I don't even know if I can trust the people that are coming to me with this advice, then I'm going to find an outside expert and I'm going to consult with them. And I'm going to ask, hey, these people are telling me it can only be done this way. Is that true? And just find out. You know, so then you're like, oh, then my job isn't to solve all the problems. My job is to figure out how to find the right people who can solve those problems. Right. So it's the exact same problem, but one station that I just outlined for you, that I sang for you, feels better. Or it should. If it doesn't, then we got to find a new one. Right. Does that make sense?
It does. Does that figure out what the right story is? Tell myself, but I like the analogy.
Yeah, and I think you should try the story on that I just gave you. This happens, by the way, all the time for CEOs. You know, when a CEO comes in from another industry and they take over a business that they don't have a lot of expertise in, really great CEOs will literally say, well, I have the authority to make this decision. I'm not qualified to make that decision. My VP of this is qualified. I'm not. So I'm going to cede that authority to them. Or a CEO will go out and find an outside expert in case they don't trust their internal expertise. And they'll benchmark it. And so if the internal person is saying, oh, that'll take 10 weeks, or it's impossible to do in less than 10 weeks, and you go outline it with an expert outside, and they go, oh, we did that in 4 weeks all the time. Then you can go back and say, I think you can get it done in 4 weeks. And if you need help on how to do that, I know the right person. So I think just playing with that frame there. The other frame that I want you to explore is, instead of using what's happening now and making an analogy to the biggest catastrophe in 100 years, it's also good to play with, what if this isn't anything like 2008 and 2007? What if you can never step in the same river twice? And even though there are cycles and market changes and things that tend to repeat, this is a brand new world in which every new world is full of opportunities. You don't even have to know what they are. You can just sit in a place of going, something really good comes from these new unprecedented times. And so instead of telling the narrative of decline, you can tell the narrative of new beginnings, because every ending gives rise to a new beginning. So there's something new that's on the horizon that's coming. We may or may not know what it is. But anyway, all I'm trying to do, that sounds like a long lecture I just gave, but I'm just trying to help any of you, by the way, that are listening, that this is the work of leadership and performance. It's choosing new stories.
And Christine, I like your statement, your comment. And journaling is something, and Shane, I think Brian might have told you what had happened to us personally right before I signed up with you. You may not remember.
He didn't tell me. No. If you feel like sharing, I'm all ears.
We had our neighbor's son, who is a third son of mine. Our kids have grown up together for 17 years, took his own life on January 3rd. So we've been trying to deal with that as well.
Thank you for sharing.
Back to journaling.
Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, you've got people here that are holding that with you.
I appreciate
That is a special and unimaginable kind of pain. And I appreciate you sharing it with us.
So I'll try to keep this on the professional side.
Now that I don't make a big distinction between those two.
Yeah. He gets to decide what professional looks like. I'm gonna throw that back at you. And this is for all of you. And this is, by the way, thank you for sharing and being so vulnerable. This is like my first time being here. So I don't even know, like, I don't have any content or background, but you know, everything we just talked about, it will happen to all of us in a different content, right? And that's where I always have to bring myself back to the reality. How is this true? I was debating with the same thing and the burnout and like my clients are not having success. And I'm like, how do I know it's true? It's just in my head and the story I was telling myself from the past or the future, bringing me back to the reality. But I also want this book to be in front of all of you guys' desks. It's by Louise Hayes, You Can Heal Your Life. This goes very deep into how energy and trauma, internal shit, turns into actual disease later on. So the trauma you experience with the loss, like, don't hold it in. It will creep up on it like later on in a different way. You're like, where did this come from? So everyone needs to have this. There's a lot of notes in here. But what I love about this book is, you know, at the end of this book, like, it has physical, you know, actual physical like things that we experience, and tells you what kind of trauma you need to heal to overcome that. So maybe you're having like shoulder pain. Well, what does that look like? Why do you experience shoulder pain? What emotions you need to let go to heal that? And it tells you the healing modality. So highly recommended. Get this on Amazon, binge read it, watch it, learn it, and apply it. That's the key, like actually apply this. So I'm a clinician in the holistic wellness space. So, and just getting into understanding the power of this because we're not taught this in school.
No.
Can you put the name of that in the chat, please?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, good book, good recommendation. Louise Hayes, you can definitely trust. She's got a tremendous amount of wisdom. I don't think she's living anymore. I think she passed away, if I'm not mistaken. So can I ask Steve, I won't spend too much time on this, mostly for your sake. I'm very happy to sit with you in it, but I think all of us are, but I want to respect that you're probably not wanting to go into deep stuff all the time at this moment, but what is it that you find is helping you get through the day when you're dealing with this kind of grief?
Good question. I don't know. I had somebody ask me that yesterday, and my sons are talking to therapists. Everybody's trying. They can't even get a therapist nowadays, which is staggering. But the parents of this child on a 6-week wait list, and the father found him, and it just tears my heart out. The doctor asked me the other day, I was seeing my general doctor. He's like, what are you doing to deal with this? How are you getting through the day? And we're just pushing through. And not necessarily the best way, but kind of what's going
on. What part of the world do you live in?
Richmond, Virginia.
Richmond, Virginia. Okay, so it's kind of cold now outside.
It's going to be like 78 today. Typically, we'd be in the 30s probably.
Wow, okay. One thing I'm going to recommend for you is to get out in nature. And to...
Bay Beach.
What's that?
Jessica just mentioned she's in Virginia Beach, so...
There you go. Get out of nature and where and when you can, where it's comfortable to do, lay on the ground. So when I was a chaplain at UCLA Medical Center, I would go from room to room and we would confront horrific experiences. People were having severe traumas, gunshot wounds, suicide attempts, all kinds of things that people lived through. And each time I would enter the room, I would take on more of that grief and pain and suffering. And one of the techniques that my supervisor gave me, there were two that were very useful. One is warm water. Immerse yourself in warm water and allow the water, if you can, even add Epsom salts. I know this sounds weird, but it has an impact on you, the energetics of your system. And the other is laying on the ground outside. Find grass or ground where you can lay down for a little bit and just look up. But the main thing is there's actually something about the magnetics of the earth and how they connect to the human being that can actually bring some of the pain and the suffering away from your body. Because this is a physical kind of pain, not just mental or emotional. So those are just two little techniques that don't require effort. You know, I think the last thing I want to give you is like an effortful thing to go do and actively work. I think at this point, it's literally just like lay on the earth and let her be like a mother to you that just holds you and you don't have to be or do anything and allow it to do its work. The same thing would be if you have a hot tub or if you have access to water that you can immerse yourself in for even 10, 15 minutes and just let it do its thing. Just something physical, which is also connected to the five and the Enneagram, which tends to get up into their head a lot. And so this is a way to tend to your body during this time.
I appreciate that. I certainly didn't mean to dominate the call here.
Yeah, well, I think all of us are pretty comfortable with it. We all see how serious this is, and we are here for you. Good. Okay. Well, it's okay for us to switch gears. So if somebody else has something they want to talk about, I think Steve might even welcome a little bit of the spotlight off of him for a few minutes. So feel free to bring something else up. Anything else can be mundane. Steve, thanks again for your trust. We hold it, seriously.
I just want to say that Davia and Debbie and I have been implementing the Enneagram, and we took them first, and it definitely startled some. Davia's not in here. Oh, Debbie's not in here either, but it definitely startled Davia, the results that she got. I just, you know how when you were saying that, like, oh, you're going to read through, and you were like, oh, I'm definitely not that person, and then you are that person. So she definitely had that shock. And then, you know, it just made her think about how she's run her business this long and, you know, how things could potentially have been taken the wrong way by the person that she is and all this. And so, yeah, we've been implementing that. We've actually slowly been having our team, like, different positions taking it. And we really like it. So if anybody hasn't taken that yet, we definitely agree with Shane that it's important. And I think for a long time, Davia kind of ran the business in a sense that it's a business and it's not like how you mentioned a second ago, how like personal and business is very, or personal and professional. And I feel like it's very old school to very keep those so separate and that one of them doesn't feed into the other, because it does. Just as much as our personal life feeds into our work life feeds into our home life. And if you're stressed at work, it's going to come over at home as well. But Davia has definitely kind of taken that approach of, hey, this is my way, isn't the only way, and we can be a company and grow together and invest in each other and all of that. So I definitely want to thank you for the Enneagram thing last week, because it's definitely helped people realize, because it's kind of funny, people that might not get along in our company and they're like, oh, you're the same number as me. You're the same type as me. And okay, well, yeah, that just, you know, that could turn, you know, being too similar to people that you work so closely with sometimes can get in the way, but understanding why you're probably hitting walls and stuff was beneficial.
I'm so happy to hear that. Yeah, it's a super powerful tool when used well. Jessica, what is your type?
I'm a type 8.
Oh, okay. And what was Davy again? Is she a 2?
She was a 3.
She's a 3. She's a 3. Yes. Okay, got it.
Yes. Yeah.
And do you Do you feel like you can see that? Do you feel like you see the eight in you, and you see the three in her?
Yes. Yes. And I think she's trying over the past year or so to more so become an eight and not the three, not like over, because I feel like with a three, it's kind of like overbearing, and she can kind of step on people's toes and be more like it's, you know, it's my way, not our way, and all of that. I think she's a, am I getting the numbers confused? Is she a three?
I think she might be a three, but I don't know. What you just described was way more an eight than a three.
Let me see what her thing was. Is hers the, is number three the achiever?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. That's what she is. And, okay. So she just, I'm looking at the thing right now.
It's a little more chameleon and, really focused on getting things done, and her life becomes an endless to-do list.
Yes.
Very concerned with efficiency, and they tend to be workaholics, can be.
Yes. And then any sort of obstacle that like gets in the way or like throws a wrench in the machine, it's just like a burden to her. And you can feel that, you know, and so she feels that when maybe past employees had come to her feeling, you know, just throwing any sort of wrench, whether it was a personal life and they needed to leave or they needed time off, or, hey, I know you explained this a couple times, but I'm still not getting it, or whatever. And she thinks that maybe some employees have felt that burden that was, you know, coming off of her, that you're kind of putting a wrench in things. And I just want to get my goals taken care of and get the job done and not worry about all this extra.
Absolutely. Yeah, good. Well, this is all really good awareness, really powerful awareness. And I'm glad you're both learning about yourselves and how you're going to be showing up. That's awesome.
Definitely.
And are you finding it useful for you?
Am I finding what?
The Enneagram, is it useful for you?
It is. Yeah, I definitely think that I can be like overpowering, kind of like, you know, stomping around and making people feel intimidated because I am so direct. It's definitely been told to me that in my personal life, maybe not in my professional life.
Yeah.
No one's ever really just come out and been like, hey, stop being this way, because I don't feel comfortable coming to talk to you or anything like that. But I can see how that can happen.
One thing that's helpful for eights to understand about themselves is that they're by nature what's called a high bandwidth person. So high bandwidth means that your emotional range, you know, if you have a neutral emotional state and then you have a positive emotional state that goes 1 to 10 and a negative emotional state that goes -1 to -10.
Yeah.
What that often means is when you're a high bandwidth person, your 4 is somebody else's 10. So when you're at a mild level of irritation, they might experience it as deep anger. And that's why eights live with a state of often feeling quite misunderstood, because they're like, what? All I said was, I don't understand why that's even, what do you mean? I just was telling you this and I don't under. And so it's really interesting as eights become more and more awake to their intensity. They have a tremendous amount of intensity that they can see how that emotion charges their words and dials things up a lot more. So one thing I tell eights is if you're at an emotional negative state of a 6, don't have conversations until you get down to a 4 or 5. because that 6 is going to be 10 for everybody else. And for you, it'll be like, yeah, it's irritating and I want to address it and it's important to me. But you're not going to be like rageful. You're just going to be like angry, mildly.
Right.
And it'll just be experienced differently by others. So that's just a good thing for you to notice too, is one of the awareness questions in that page is, what has been my level of intensity since I last checked? And for eights, it's often like 10, always. I'm just at a 10, always. And so then you have to ask, when was the last time you were a 5? What did that look and feel like? You know, oh, I was watching TV with my husband. Oh, okay, that was a 5. You know, that was me relaxing and
I probably still was intense about that too.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Depends on what I'm watching. Yeah. So,
yeah.
So anyway, that can be helpful for you as well. It doesn't sound like you have as much of that in your work life, but even in your personal life, that can be really useful for you to kind of notice.
It can. I actually talked about it with my fiance and I was like, we did this test. And he's like, oh my gosh. He was like, yeah, that's really spot on. He was like, you're just so direct and forward. And, you know, he's like, I mean, you know, people learn to love it about you because they just always know where they stand. And, you know, they always know that you're going to be upfront and honest and not let anything go. But he's like, I can definitely see how people could take that the wrong way.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I've taken a number of different personality tests throughout the years. And I think the Enneagram is probably one of the more enlightening ones that kind of peeled back different layers that I hadn't seen before. I knew I was an introvert. I knew this, I knew that, but that got into that level of my personality. I was pretty shocked. Not shocked, but it was very revealing, I should say.
Yeah. Totally. And that's kind of what some of our staff is feeling like. They're like, oh, you know, I'm kind of on this like self journey and learning about myself and reflecting. And it's not really something I've done before. And they were like, who knew that you know, especially our new employees, they were like, who knew that starting a new job would bring this along with it? You know, because so many companies just don't really care. And it's just, it is the way it is, or leave your problems at home and, or leave your personalities at home and all, we're just going to be robots. So.
I have a question about that. Shane, what is a good way? What I discovered today is that my company works in the black very much, right? So some of those more warm and fuzzies, right? I would love to know with my leadership team, like what is their Enneagram? What is their leadership language? What's a good way to ask them to do it? I have a hard time just positioning that in the environment that we're in.
Yeah, if you have leaders that tend to be in that bandwidth, it's going to be a hard sell, honestly, especially if you're going up the chain. You know, that starts to feel exposing and invasive for them. Mm-hmm. If boundaries and autonomy and things like that are really important to them, and you're like, hey, can I crawl inside your brain a little bit and just see what makes you tick? They're not going to like that very much. Mm-hmm. But I do think you can. I don't recommend you outright type people, of course, without their doing it or whatever, but you can use the general movements that comprise the Enneagram to help you map what you might be seeing and what might be driving motivation. For example, you could look at their relationship to emotions. Are they really present to their emotions, or they tend to live above their emotions? So, the five and the three lives in a really, and nine, five, three, and nine tend to be really suspended from their emotional life. Like it happens, but they tend to not be super connected to it. Whereas like a one and a two, and I think probably four to some extent, but more one and two, they're more suppressing emotion. So anyway, those are things you can consider, but you can also look at the harmonics. So a harmonic is the positive outlook group. So it's 7, 9, 2. They tend to reframe everything positively. So you could say, oh, that's a positive group. Then you have the competency group, which is like 1, 3, 5. And that's basically when I don't get what I want, I just need to get down to doing it better. I need to work harder. I need to know more. I need to try better at whatever, right? And then you have the reactive group, which is the 4, 6, and 8, which is I have a right to these emotions and you're going to hear about it. And so sometimes that just gives you like, oh, okay, we're dealing with that energy somewhere here. You can also look at assertive, withdrawn, and compliant. So if you recall, the 9, 5, and 4 are more withdrawn types. They want to be more wallflower, observing what's happening rather than actively engaged. If you look at the 8, the 3, and the 7, that triangle is assertive. They're asserting themselves out into the world. And then if you look at 1, 6, and 2, that is the compliant group. They're trying to be compliant to either abstract codes or the social needs or the needs of others. And if you look at the training online bonus 4, I believe, 3, the Enneagram that I did before, you can go back there and kind of look at review some of those things. And the more familiar you get with the Enneagram, the more you'll just naturally sense and start to feel people. And then you don't have to get them to take a test. And you can kind of operate within that. So I don't recommend you try to get people to take it. The only way that I would do is you could say, hey, I took two really interesting inventories that helped me learn a lot about myself. And I thought it might be useful for you if I shared that with you. I might help you know how to, you know me a little better, know how to manage me. Not that you're not doing a good job, but just give you some insight. And here are the results. That's another way, so that they may not turn around and go, oh, I want to take this, but they may make good use of it. They might realize, like, oh, yeah, I don't even think about this thing called recognition that seems really important to you. And I hadn't even occurred to me. So sometimes it can be helpful for that.
We had a decent amount of staff that was very like, just another thing I'm going to have to do or take or whatever. And then they actually did it. And we had them actually take all three. So we did like another DISC assessment, the five leaderships, and then the Enneagram. And it was kind of surprising to see the people who, some people were like, oh yeah, sure, I'll do it. And then others, were a little bit more like, just another thing I had to do. But then we got in a strategy meeting and we were talking about it. And, we also put it into real life. Okay. So in an email, if I have a problem, what is the best way to communicate? Like for me, I'm a bullet point person. I don't want a long paragraph. So we kind of put it into real life situations that could happen at our job. And people were really, they came around and a whole conversation would spark about it. And, oh, I can see why this person was like this. So I would definitely throw it out there and see who could just take it. And we had a good turnaround and we were not expecting that.
For sure. You know, when it comes to the other thing I'm thinking about, Mindy, is, you know, local experiments are a powerful way to create change in an organization when you don't have authority. So for example, when a team leader starts doing something with their team and that team starts getting different results and starts having new experiences and they're talking about it, it's a little bit like being in the campfire and having a great time and you're kind of wanting to peek over the fence and know what's going on in this cool campfire you guys are having. That can evoke that from senior leadership sometimes. So that if you start rolling a couple of these tools out to your team and just start using them more regularly and create a shared language and, in time, people will be like, wait, what are you talking about? What's the number? Just keep talking about your numbers. What are your numbers? You're like, oh, you should take this. It's the Enneagram. It's amazing. And then they kind of go, oh, okay, I'll be a part of that. So those are some other ways to get indirectly them to have their own buy-in.
That's how we
have
did
you
that.
Had anybody, have you had anybody below you take?
I haven't. Okay. And that's actually where I would be interested in starting is like the team I directly manage, like my leadership team, right? I'm not for really sure. Like my, I think I know what my bosses are like.
Oh, cool. Okay. Got it.
Yeah. But like okay, my, so I think it would be a useful for the team to have as well, for them to get familiar with it. But I don't want to seem, my internal fear is like, oh, I'm going to seem too woo, Mindy's all woo woo about this test. These emotions we're going to talk about.
Yeah. Are these people that are your peers or people that report to you?
Report to me.
Oh, I wouldn't worry about that at all. That's okay. Easy. You have power and authority to just tell people, hey, this is what I need from you. We're doing this. And it's okay that you think it's lame.
Yeah.
Personally, okay. I wouldn't bring up the emotion side of it because I think in one of our groups, we kind of did that. And in our other groups, we kind of brought it to, hey, this is the best way to learn how to communicate the best with each other and be more productive and just kind of put it into a sense where it wasn't all like about feelings. So maybe try to word it a little bit differently so they don't think that it's all based on.
Yeah. No, good point.
And some folks just are not. They don't have any exposure to these types of tests. And I've done them for years. I've always found them very interesting. And maybe do the leader test with them first. Say, hey, we're going to do two of them. Here's, I want to do this first one just to see what you're, so it's quick and it's easy. It's not real invasive. And it might kind of soften the beaches for you. And then you do the Enneagram one after that.
Okay.
Yep. That's, that's a great strategy. Both those are, I agree with that input.
That's the order we did ours in. We did our leadership, and then Davia and I and Debbie took our Enneagram. So we just kept talking about our numbers, and it like just got people to engage and be a little questionable. So then when we brought it up, everyone was kind of like feeling like, oh, I get to take this, not that I have to take this. Where the leadership one that we did first, we kind of felt like they were like, oh, we have to take this. So
that one word, we get to take this, alone could have an impact on their acceptance of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's how you spin it.
Yep. I tell people that all the time. I'm like, I get to wake up and do what I will, and you know, go to work and work and do all. I don't have to do it. I get to do it.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, we did it. We did it in certain organizations that you weren't allowed to get access to it until you were at a certain level or something, and that made it like people were just wanted it so bad. And then we rolled it out to everybody after. But we started it that way so that it had that quality of elitism that people wanted.
That's kind of a funny way to do it.
Yeah, it is. It's like, well, we've instituted something. People at this level get access to this. And they're like, well, how come we don't? We're like, well, you know what? We're going to try it. We're going to let you have access to this. but oddly, I've had very few people resistant to it. And I've been in construction. I've been in all kinds of industries that you would think people could roll their eyes and not care. But most people find it super interesting to learn about themselves at a deep level. We're all narcissistic enough. Good. What else is going on? Anything else you guys want to chat about? We got a few more minutes. I'm happy to stick around, or we can.
No, I don't have anything.
Okay.
Yeah. Speaking of bosses, I'm being summoned, so I have to sign off for now. Thank you.
Bye, guys. See you next week.
Okay. Take it easy. Steve, you can stick around if you want. If there's anything more you want to chat about, I'm here for you if you need anything.
I want to touch on the story part one more time. So okay. We brought it up with, you know, what frames can I put in place? What's my story? What will improve my emotions? One thing I've talked about with my son, and I've got two sons, and they were pretty heavily impacted by their friend they grew up with taking his life. And I said, you know, we're not gonna be able to take you from deeply depressed to, you know, ecstatic. What can we do to move the needle just a little bit? So out of a, you know, range of 100, if we can go from a 20 to a 23, that's a step in the right direction.
Yeah. I'll give you a few frames if you want around this kind of loss that you've experienced.
This has been, now that it's just us, this has been the worst month and a half in my life, probably. This has been harder than, you know, the loss of my own father. And now it's just us. My youngest, actually.
I'm gonna stop recording if that's all right.
Yes. Yeah, thank you.
You were.